Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, well, let's do a bit of a brainstorm. I mean, nothing like tips from our community to keep us going in tough times. And let's face it, the last few years have been pretty tough. A once-in-a-century pandemic, worrying about our loved ones, our jobs, the future, not being able to visit family. It's been difficult at times to get a grip on just what's happened over the last few years. And it's seemed relentless too, hasn't it? Lockdowns, botched vaccine rollouts. Today, Alice Springs has gone into lockdown, and now large parts of the country are trying fruitlessly to find rapid antigen tests for their families. It's a mess. If you're in WA, of course, you've managed to avoid quite a bit of this stress, and good on you. But look, no doubt that we're having to live right now with lots of uncertainty. So I'd love to hear from you tonight. How are you keeping afloat? What have you pulled on over the last couple of years to get through? Could be anything from a morning walk to taking up a new hobby, or just practicing good old, you know, suck it up stoicism. We're not trying to give everyone a false sense of positivity, understand the situation, but it's more practical advice about how to deal with a tough situation we're all in. Some of us, of course, doing it tougher than others. Joining us tonight to lead the discussion is Greg Murray. Greg's Professor of Psychology at Swinburne University of Technology. Greg, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks, Phil. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thanks for that very rich introduction to what we're talking about. I really like your emphasis on putting looking for the positives and looking for coping strategies that are really working for people. That sort of brainstorming flavour, I think, is the right way to approach this.
Yeah. I just think, look, you know, even if you haven't been really directly and badly affected in your own family, the constant nagging anxiety of this thing across the population has taken a big toll. I mean, it's tough. It's tough on the mind, isn't it? Just this daily nagging anxiety of what's, you know, am I going to be safe? Is it going to be all right? Are the members of my family I'm worried about, are they going to be all right? Even if it's not on your doorstep, that thought of it, and not all of us have dealt with that well, I suspect. Do you think?
Yeah, look, that's exactly right. So the latest figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics said that something like, 48.5% of Australians reported feeling anxiety and worry. So about half of us reported feeling anxiety and worry. That was in April 2021. And that had come down from August 2020, where it was up closer to 60%. My strong guess is with the Omicron surge that happened in Melbourne, at least in December and other parts of Australia at different times, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we were back up around the 60% mark of people who, if you asked them, they were, you know, reporting anxiety and worry. And as you say, Phil, there's a whole lot of different things you could be anxious and worried about. You could be worried about getting COVID. You could be worried about your family getting COVID. You could be worried about your job, et cetera, et cetera. But I also agree with you, Phil, that I think another thing that's happened is there's just this a bit almost an exhaustion. You know, I think a lot of us were hopeful that this would get sorted in 2021, you know, and the vaccines would roll out and there'd be a different world. Clearly, that's not the case, and we sort of start 2022 with, you know, as much uncertainty as we had in 2021, and I think that's kind of triggered a few people to really think, oh man, you know, yeah.
No, I agree. I think that's right. I'm just trying to think, you know, back to a time in the past. You might have to go back away to get a time when, you know, the level of national anxiety about something was as widespread as this.
Yeah, well, people talk about wars, and you know, and the Spanish flu, of course, and other situations where there were major public health issues. It's definitely got that flavour. Of course, in a way, we're lucky, aren't we? You know, not that many people are dying of COVID. The disease itself is not as bad as some other things humans have faced over the years.
No, it's not.
However, the disruption and the uncertainty is very pervasive. And of course, you know, the other thing that's going on, of course, is the media is, you know, loves a good story to keep us all worried. And so, you know, we unless we're careful, we will be flooded with concerning information all day, every day. And that's not even mentioning social media.
What do you think about that? I mean, I've had a lot of discussions over the summer about that with other people, I mean, many of which I've agreed with when people have said, you know, I don't think the media's really done a good job here in lots of ways. I think I agree. I mean, I agree with lots of, with criticisms of lots of the coverage, which, you know, has been over the top, hasn't it? What do you think about it?
Yeah, look, I'm not really an expert on, you know, on the media, and my position would be a bit more gentle than that. I wouldn't sort of say there's something wrong with the coverage. I think it's just the amount of coverage and the fact that they're, you know, a bad news story is very compelling for people. So I couldn't point to particular examples where I think the media should have done things differently. You know, there's been very good examples on the ABC, for example, just staying very close to the data. You know, I've actually been really, as a scientist, as a behavioural scientist, I've been very impressed with how carefully people have stuck to the data and said things like, well, you know, this could happen, but we have no evidence of that. And we've got people like Norman Swan, you know, real experts in translating complex scientific information to the public. So there are some really good examples, but of course it's just the amount of it.
There's a tone to a lot of it though too. And as I say, well, I'm trying to be careful here because, you know, obviously this is a serious matter. I'm certainly not trying to gloss over it, but, you know, there's been a tone to a lot of it as though the system is about to collapse.
Yes.
That hospitals are in absolute crisis. You know, that's not actually true. It's not actually true. I mean, there's no doubt there's pressure. And I'm not, as I say, I'm not trying to underplay that at all. But that sense when you open, you know, you open a screen in the morning or look at your phone in the morning or turn on the television, that you know, you're in imminent danger. I wonder about the level of coverage of it and the effect it's having on us all. Do you?
Yeah. Yes, I definitely do. From the perspective of psychology that I do know a little bit about, there has been some very interesting research into this. So with the bird flu pandemic, or epidemic, was that ever called a pandemic? I'm not sure.
No,
but anyway,
it was a serious matter, an outbreak of bird flu. And we thought we would be affected by it, but of course we never were.
We weren't, but certain countries were. And so some research was done in countries that were affected by this on the impact of media usage. And there was a very strong association between individuals' anxiety and the number of hours a day that they engaged with the media. And so in terms of what we can control in terms of our own quality of life and our well-being, I think it is a very reasonable suggestion for people that they minimise their contact with information and be very careful about where they get their information from. So 15 or 20 minutes a day would be, if you find yourself to be getting anxious about COVID and the implications of COVID and the hospital system, as you were saying, if you find yourself to be getting anxious, I think it would be a very wise strategy to simply disengage with the media as much as possible. You know, the ABC has its very good CoronaCast, which is, you know, a little few minutes each day. I think they've now gone to weekly. But some reliable source of information that's just going to present it to you straight and not slide off into the politics and the argy-bargy too much and the doomsaying. But 15, 20 minutes a day and then stop. Because one of the things we do know psychologically is humans are, you know, very interested in threat. Anything that's threatening is kind of seductive for us. We get tunnel vision on it.
Why is that? I mean, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you can see it in the way that this has been covered and it leads to these anxiety levels. Why, in psychological terms, why is danger and threat so seductive?
Yeah. It's because of evolution, and of course, what's happened is the members of the species who were threat sensitive are the ones who survived. And humans have an alarm reaction to deal with threat, and we experience that as anxiety. Other species have other strategies for dealing with threat. Think of shells, for example. Mm. Some creatures are permanently defended. The human strategy is one where we save our fight and flight energies for situations where it's triggered. Because it's in human beings, this fight or flight response, the anxiety response, is a very high energy response. And all of us have experienced it, you know, that racing heart rate, speeding up of the breath, the blood running to the muscles. The body will activate that fight or flight response whenever there is something that suggests it might be threatening. Now, in particular, we are on the lookout for new threats. And I think this is sort of something you were hinting at, Phil. There, of course, are lots of other threats to our well-being than COVID. One of the interesting statistics that I don't know if everyone knows, but last year in Australia, there was a net decrease in mortality.
See, how about that? Right? See, how about that?
A net decrease in mortality. We didn't read that.
No,
there was not much celebration of that. Hmm. So, of course, what happened is last year not many people died of COVID, thankfully. Obviously, every death is tragic, but not many people did.
No.
Far fewer people, I presume, I haven't dug down into the data, but far fewer people, I presume, died in car accidents and fights outside pubs.
In other words, of all causes, mortality last year was down.
In Australia. Age-adjusted, it was down in Australia. The ABS has published that. But, yes, you're exactly right. That wasn't front-page news. Congratulations, Australia. Less of us, you know, died of other causes than and flu and those other things that didn't happen last year.
Yeah.
Now, 2022 could be different, but our point is that there are many things that you could be concerned about in terms of you and your family's health and well-being and the future and, you know, climate change, et cetera, and other challenges that we all face and other health issues and mental health issues. But it's if you pick up a newspaper or especially if you go on social media, it's as if COVID is the only challenge we've got. And that is clearly a manifestation of the fact that humans are particularly seduced by new or novel threats, and they're particularly seduced by uncertainty. And man, have we got some uncertainty going on. You know, that is one of the defining features of this challenge is, you know, any intelligent person looking around at what's going on right now, particularly, of course, it's really unclear the government strategy is, what individuals are meant to do if they get symptoms, etc. Mm. It's really nowhere near as clear as it was 6 or 8 months ago, for example. So we have ongoing uncertainty, which I believe we're starting to see in the markets, etc.
Mm.
So, yeah, these are the sorts of the preconditions for humans to get very, very anxious, and some of us are.
What happens to our brain under prolonged stress?
Well, for most of us, thanks for that question. For most of us, it's fine, right? So there's, you know, we're, as I said before, we're designed to have this stress response. So there's nothing wrong with feeling anxious. There's nothing wrong with feeling like, you know, you want to flee or fight or you've got some worries going on. Nothing wrong with it at all. Some of us are a bit more prone to those sorts of responses and we can get them more severely. And, of course, as you said in your intro, Phil, for some people it's been harder than others. And the data actually is pretty clear on that. And your listeners won't be surprised to hear this, that the people who are struggling more with the psychology of COVID are the same sort of people who had struggles before COVID.
Mm.
So they're people who had pre-existing mental disorders, people with socioeconomic disadvantage, people in marginalized groups. The vulnerable in our society are the ones who we are concerned may be having more of a sort of what we might call a clinical response to COVID. Now, you know, clinical levels of anxiety that are impairing their functioning, getting in the way of them living a normal life. And of course, it's those people, you know, maybe 20 or 30% of the population who we would encourage to get help. And that's not so much the focus of tonight's discussion, where we're talking more to the majority of people, though remembering that there are a significant minority who do experience these problems as clinically significant, and they should really get help because there is good help available. But tonight we're talking more about what individuals can do themselves.
Yeah.
And as you said right at the start, what are those coping strategies, techniques, things people have found? And we'll unpack those and make a bit of sense of them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the number to call, I mean, how are you dealing with it, and what works for you? We're sort of looking for some positivity here. Matt the truckie called in, just left a message saying, I've removed my social media account from my phone. And I've stopped reading the news. That's how I've dealt with it. Actually,
yeah.
Matt, that may improve your life in all sorts of other ways, I suspect, as well. You have a habit of finding out about stuff that's really important, whether you want to find out about it or not, I think, don't
true.
You?
True. And I think the thing with the electronic forms of getting information, as we all know, is you can slide down the rabbit hole. So the problem is you might start on the ABC website just reading very sensible, calm statistical information, but then there'll be a link and off you go to, you know, some more dramatic version and some epidemiologist predicting this or some cardiologist is pointing out this new blah, 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 or the chair of Pfizer is saying this. So that is an issue with the electronic ways of collecting information. You really are in a much more open information environment than you were in the old days of the ABC News on the telly or the newspaper, where you were going to stay in that field of knowledge and you were not going to leave it. But that's not what happens now. And so I have had clients who have been and other people in my life who've been very anxious about COVID, and they've done exactly what Matt has done. They have closed off access to these more concerning and also, let's face it, less reliable sources of information. And that's been very beneficial to them. And they start to realise, well, actually their day-to-day life is nowhere near a crisis.
Exactly. Just a couple of texts here too. I'm finding mindfulness is helpful. I've dabbled in meditation over the years. Now I'm committing to it and finding it slows the monkey mind.
Fantastic.
And reduces anxiety. A lot of people do swear by this, don't they? It's not transcendental meditation of the old kind. It's just trying to be meditatively mindful. I know it's a bit of a buzzword these days, but there does seem to be a lot of people do get some help from this, don't they?
Yes, I agree with both those things. It is a bit of a buzzword. Mindfulness was on the front page of Time magazine a few years ago, and it's everywhere. However, it is also the case that a lot of people get benefit from it. And in particular in Australia, there's a group called Smiling Mind, and they have an app that they built originally for kids, but it now has an adult component to it as well. And myself and many other psychologists are referring people to that as the core stress management or anxiety management tool. Just because the content is so well organized. The new forms of mindfulness have largely the spiritual component removed. I mean, obviously it emerged from the Eastern religious traditions, but the new forms have had that removed. And what's really nice about this Smiling Mind product is, you know, the voices are Australian and some of the terminology is not so flowery as some of the American type products. I myself and many psychologists are a big fan of it. And mindfulness now is mentioned in all the sort of standard lists of coping strategies and responding to anxiety for very good reason. And there's very good data to support it. In fact, to go back to your earlier question, there's good evidence that mindfulness is also very good for brain functioning. There's something about that mental state that we get into when we're sitting in a non-judgmental awareness of the present moment. That's what mindfulness is. The brain likes that. But it seems to be very refreshing for the brain. So, yes, lots of people have been directed to that, and really I can't remember the last time I had a client or someone I referred to that who didn't say, oh, that's good.
Yeah, a couple of texts here. Lisa says, human beings need leadership. Without a sense of hope, people become anxious and fear a sense of lack of control. I think that's probably true as well. Would you think, Greg, a sense that somebody at least is in charge, that that helps usually, doesn't it?
I think it does. However, I agree with Lisa broadly. I do think, however, some of the things we've been talking about tonight, about especially in the social media space, where of course we get a lot of polarisation. You know, we saw a lot of that between, you know, the Labor states and the Liberal federal government. You know, that's not my area of expertise, but I think we all saw that. So it's hard to talk about political leadership without getting into an emotionally intense space. And so as a psychologist, I would tend to not emphasize what Lisa's emphasized, even though I don't disagree with her. But as a psychologist, I would more emphasize the things that are within our control.
Yeah.
And who the Prime Minister is or the Premier is not within my control. And so I personally, as a psychologist, wouldn't be encouraging people to fret or pay too much attention to that, unless, of course, that's very, very meaningful for them and there's activities that flow from that, you know, if they're a member of a political party, for example. You know, obviously pursuing valued actions is a very good way of dealing with stress. So if that's who you are, yes, of course.
Yeah, okay. Joanne, hello.
Oh, hi. Oh, this whole debacle is it is really taxing. And for me, I actually have three family members on. I'm very happy that I'm in Tasmania, but I have three family members on the mainland who have COVID, and they've been vaccinated and the whole show, as have I. But there's so many other issues that, for me personally, I find incredibly difficult. You know, COVID seems to have sort of eclipsed some of the issues of climate change, and there's just so much of that.
What do you do yourself, Jode? What do you do in yourself to deal with that, with those feelings?
Oh gosh, look. I definitely have practiced mindfulness, but just of late, with all of it going on, I found myself losing the thread of mindfulness. You know, but the best thing is to go and look at my garden or go to the beach and just stay put, you know.
That's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah, look, that's, I mean, Greg, that's, a lot of people are texting in saying this business of reconnecting with nature. You know, I mean, we're not sounding, you know, superficial here. It can have a profound effect, profound calming effect on you, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And it is typically mentioned in the list of positive coping strategies. And we often hear people, And I really liked what Joanne was saying too. She's raising the issue that for most of us, of course, we have other challenges, whether it be, you know, shared challenges like climate change or personal challenges like health issues or worries about our job. So often, you know, what's really challenging psychologically is the interaction or the accumulation of problems. So that's why I think, you know, you said right at the start, Phil, we're all a bit sick of COVID, and in a sense, that's right. In, from a psychological viewpoint, and as Joanne said, it kind of is eclipsing some of the subtleties and the individual experiences that really matter to people. And that's where sometimes nature comes in. And Joanne said she goes into her garden, so obviously a very specific part of nature that she's worked on and tended and cared for. So all those positive associations with her garden. So what I like about Joanne's coping strategy is she's talking about something that's deeply personal.
Yeah.
And it is often those personal things that are the solution, even to things that we treat as a big public problem like COVID, because obviously it's how it impacts the individual that really matters. And you know, there are lots of examples in the literature and in clinical anecdote about people really finding a lot of value in connecting to nature. And of course, a lot of people combine connecting to nature with a bit of exercise. So going for a walk or a jog or a bike ride. I bike ride myself, and I'm seeing many, many more people on their bikes than I've ever seen before, which is great. So I'm hoping that one of the benefits of COVID is people have, in fact, been open to trying new coping styles, things that they haven't done before.
Yeah.
And of course, if you have been doing mindfulness, like Joanne said, yes, of course, it's been going on for 2 years, this thing, and I don't know about other issues in Joanne's life, but we might be a bit sick of that strategy. So one of the things I was hoping to do tonight was really to create an environment where people started to think, oh, there's something else I might try.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I suppose I wanted to stress with you too, Greg, and get your confirmation on this, is that humans are built for this too, in a way, aren't we? When we are adapted to deal with uncertainty. It's not as though this is out of the blue in terms of our own experience and our own resilience and our own capacity to deal with it too.
Absolutely right. We really don't want to underestimate the average person's resilience. It is the case, and this is what we were talking about before, that we can get seduced by threatening information in the media.
Mm.
We can get a bit of tunnel vision on threat. We all do that, and we tend to overestimate how serious the consequences would be if something that we don't want to happen happened. And we underestimate our ability to cope, you know, and adjust should something happen that we don't want to happen. So there are mental biases that kick in.
Mm.
But the truth is that when we calm those biases down and look a bit more objectively at what's going on, yes, we are designed to cope with uncertainty. There's actually, I don't know if you know the cartoonist Michael Lunig. He's very well known in Victoria, and he's got a lovely cartoon about uncertainty. And one of his characters is speaking to a duck, and the duck is often a wise figure in these cartoons. And the character says, "But you know, we don't know what's going to happen. It could be terrible." And the duck says, "When in the past have we lived in times that were certain?" This is not unusual, and I think
I think that's right. We need to just remind ourselves of this, you know, isn't it, that uncertainty and living on the edge and all of these things and not knowing what's happening next are not weird or bizarre situations. They're relatively normal.
They are. In fact, I was talking to someone else about this, and we were thinking about it because it was at Christmas time. And we were thinking about, you know, some of the stories we tell children, right? And we tell children about Santa Claus, et cetera. But another story we tell children is things like lived happily ever after and everything's all right.
Hmm.
Now, adults know that none of those three things are true. Santa Claus, happily ever after, and everything's all right, they're not actually things that happen in the world. There are always things going wrong for people. Whether it be us personally or people we love and care about or people on the other side of the world who we've never met. That has always been the case for human beings. And navigating those choppy waters is what it's all about. And as you say, we are, on average, pretty resilient.
Yeah.
Though when we're anxious, we can forget that.
I think that's right. Carmel, hello.
Yes.
Hi, Carmel.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. How about you, Carmel?
Oh, my story's a bit complicated. If I go back in time, there were things that were said in previous periods which were relating to the idea that you have to go out of your own cocoon and step out of your front door, and I guess I must be going back to God knows when. If you're going to connect with other people and become part of the community, well, what we've found with this whole endemic is that all of that has been working against us, hasn't it? Having to stay inside, having to isolate, all of that stuff. I guess I'm a bit political in the sense that I still think that we do need to connect with others, and I guess a lot of people are trying to do that online, but we need to join up with organisations, I think, that can be named and which reflect our concerns, and then find ways to share online if we can't get outside what we're feeling. And basically, that's one of my concerns. Another one is how we treat children in this situation. The rules about what you tell them. To what? How much do you tell them? And I'd like to ask the psychologist here what she would like to advise
Let's put that to Greg. Greg, what do you think about that in terms of talking to kids about it?
Yeah, there's a couple of general rules that we normally talk about in terms of relation to kids. Firstly, protect them from the information, as we were just saying before, just so they're not flooded with it.
Yeah.
And even if the morning news and the evening news and the lunchtime news aren't bothering us, they could well be bothering our children, especially, kids in that primary school age, where I think we often overestimate their rationality. We think that, I remember when we were teaching developmental psychology, there's this great phrase that primary school children have islands of rationality. they still believe in Santa Claus, but then you can talk to them about the football scores or whatever, and they seem to be perfectly rational. We just need to be careful of what the sort of ambient information is in the house that's coming to them.
Yeah.
And then in terms of speaking to children, it's always a good general idea to ask them questions about what they think is going on, rather than leading with information, rather than guessing what information they need. So if a child happens to, look like they have concerns about this or raise concerns, a good first strategy is to ask them the question, well, what is your understanding about this COVID thing? What is your concern? And it's possible that you will actually discover that they have quite unrealistic concerns, and then it's very easy then to go and get better quality information to clarify that. And then, of course, one of the ways that children cope with uncertainty, and all parents know this, is routine and the tone of the household actually is probably more powerful than any words that are being used.
I think that's right. Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Miranda, hello, Miranda.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Hello.
How are you going?
Not too bad. Look, what do you do? What strategies do you use?
Oh, look, I was just saying to your lovely receptionist there, I get on a train and go for a trip across Norway.
Oh, yeah.
And I do that via YouTube.
Yeah.
I don't know what these stations are called, but you can go on and find these. There's no narrative. They don't narrate at all. And you can go. You feel like you're actually on these trains going through Norway or Scotland, somewhere beautiful, like through Sweden. And you really do feel, you can just, it goes for like an hour. Some of them go for 2 hours. And it sounds really boring, but because you can't go on a trip across Norway, you really feel like you're on this train. And I can just sit in my lounge room, have my aromatherapy burning with the beautiful pine essential oils, and I feel like I'm on the train in Norway. And my dear old dad, I used to drag him in. He lived next door to me. And I'd say, come on, Dad, we're going for a trip across Norway. And he loved it, absolutely loved it. No talk of COVID. I watched the ABC breakfast morning news, and that is it. Till 6 p.m.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of healthy in a way too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing I've done that's really helped is paying it forward in the Macca's queue. When you're at the drive-thru at McDonald's, I don't do it all the time. I'm not in a really affluent position myself, I must say. But every now and then when I feel really, really shithouse, I pay it forward at Macca's.
What do you mean? Sorry, what do you mean pay it forward? You mean you pay for the person behind you?
Yep, yep. And it's great. And look, I don't care if it's, it doesn't matter if it's just a $5 coffee or a $24, you know, Big Mac meal, whatever. Yeah. But it just, it's an awesome feeling driving out of the drive-thru and you've got someone hanging out the window just giving you the big thumbs up and the big wave, big smile. And I think, God, that was worth $15, you know? And I also think, too, the other thing you've got to always remember, and it's something my father told me when I was a little girl, he used to always say, now, don't complain. You could be living in Bangladesh. You know? And I always remember thinking, what do you mean? Well, those little kids in Bangladesh, they don't have lamb chops and mashed potatoes for tea. And I think that's another thing that I've been doing is thinking, well, hang on a minute. I am doing really well. I'm sitting in my lounge room on a train trip across Norway. I'm going down to the Macca's drive-thru and I can pay it forward.
Good on you.
All in the world is fantastic.
Nice, Miranda. Thank you. That's a cheerful thought too. Bart, what are you doing?
Oh, good heavens, Philip. I'm your greatest fan. Well, I'm looking at 6,000 stars.
Right now.
And I'm a few hours west of Tamworth, and I'm tending a fire. But my advice, and I had to discover this when I had to give up drinking, about mindfulness, is do you know that image when Doctor Who begins and it's this tunnel?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a tunnel that's coming towards you. And there's really nothing at the end. But then you imagine that all the junk of the day is actually falling out of your ears. Yeah, this is mad. Mm. Falling out of your ears like cauliflower. So you just imagine that the day's junk is just falling out of your head.
Yeah.
And that has got me to the, and I did it on buses, and you know, and everyone thought I was mad. But it is really, really great to feel that junk is falling out of your ears. that you know, just to visualize. Visualize that. That's my thing about mindfulness. That's how I got there. Yeah. That's how I gave up drinking.
Nice, Bart. Thank you for that. Thanks for the call and thanks for sharing that with us as well. Hello, Carl.
Yes, hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah.
What do you get up to?
Yeah. I'm just in Karratha. My home, so I've got the wife and kids over on the East Coast in Newcastle, so I work out of Karratha. Originally it was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and it's turned into, 2 years on virtually. Mm-hmm. And, just so out of the last 18 months, I've spent 10 weeks at home. But, one of my ways of dealing with the whole, COVID crisis is just to keep things as normal as they can. And I think one of the big things is just having dad at work, just treating it like it's a normal day at the office, even away from home. But we've got all this remarkable technology that we can use. And I think now, this is a time where it defines, how we should be using technology. Mm. I love getting out in the hills here, in Karratha, just walking through this majestic landscape. And that's my sanity check for the whole thing.
You're not alone with that, Carl. Thank you. Thanks for sharing with us. You're not alone with that. That reconnecting with nature. Sophie's just texted me saying not everyone can do it, but getting back to nature. Currently, I'm sitting in damp swimmers, enjoying the post sunset colours over the Indian Ocean. Thanks for remembering that. Even in WA, the virus does have impacts. I miss my only sibling's wedding, and loved relatives' funerals. But nature does help. Angela from Lilydale says, routine, daily nature walking and listening to knowledge information, good sleep, natural quality diet, and consistent daily habits too. Important. Nate from Club Almost says, escape to the patio area or balcony area for breakfast with no mobile phone. Well, that's right. I suppose these are all helpful things too, I imagine, Greg. Tell us about, there is in the psychological profession, your profession, tell us about emotion-focused coping and problem-focused coping.
Yeah, so we've got two broad categories of, you know, if we're trying to train people up on their coping skills, we distinguish between emotion-focused and problem-focused coping. Emotion-focused coping is where we're doing things that are specifically designed to soothe us or calm us if we're experiencing distressing emotions. So that could be things like exercise, which quite a few people have mentioned. It could be things like taking a warm bath, things that are aimed at dealing with the emotions themselves. Problem-focused coping is a set of procedures that is more to do with working out, well, what is the issue that I'm concerned about here? What's within my power to do something about that? And what actions can I take? So, for example, you know, if you're anxious about 2022 and how that's going to impact on your home life, if you know, if people got sick and people had to isolate, and you'd found, say, during 2021 that there were some issues with perhaps tension in the home when there were too many people in the house all day long, that's a problem. And a problem-focused coping would be to say, so what can I do about that? And, for example, you might say, okay, I really need to have that difficult discussion with my husband because I really don't think he pulled his weight in the kitchen during the year or with the childcare. So it's more actions that you take to solve the challenge or the stress versus attempts to actually ameliorate the emotional problem. And so there's a whole long list of strategies that come under those two headings, but many of them have actually been mentioned by your lovely listeners. What nice people you've got who listen to your show. They've actually just mentioned what we call the five pillars of well-being, which is another sort of set of groupings of coping strategies. So Carmel mentioned connecting with others and that lovely idea about not just connecting informally, but almost connecting through things that are meaningful for you. So organizations that reflect your concerns. Connection is one of the five things that we think really works for most people. And then Miranda's lovely story about the, it was Miranda, wasn't it, who was doing the trip across Norway?
That's
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Which is staying open and being curious. So obviously that's you know, what she conveyed very vividly with her and her dad is that curiosity about what's the next station on the Norway trip. So that's taking notice of what's going around you, paying attention to things you like, being curious about, you know, what's that taste I'm enjoying or what's that slant of the light that I'm enjoying. That's another pillar of well-being. And that paying it forward that that was Miranda as well, I think. Yes, it was mentioned. Giving to other people is one of the most powerful well-being strategies that we know about. There is something, you know, humans are fundamentally social beings, and it does seem to be the case from evidence and clinical anecdote that when we're under stress and finding challenges difficult, one of the things that works well for us is put someone else at the center of our attention, someone who's not us. Yeah. And so giving is really important. And then a few of us have already mentioned being active. That's the other major thing that we really think is important is the physical activity. And then one final one that hasn't come up so much, but I'm wondering if any of the other listeners do this, is keep learning. That is, keep open to opportunities to learn new skills, try out new, whether they be psychological things or just new information. I know a lot of people have done a lot more reading during COVID than they have before, myself included. And again, it seems to be that a lot of people have taken this opportunity to expand their habits in that direction of learning.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Doug's 70. Yeah. I'm sure he won't mind me saying that. And he's a yoga teacher. G'day, Doug.
Yeah, g'day. How are you?
Not bad.
I'm on the way home from my Monday night class at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, ever since COVID began, I've been seeing more anxiety and more stress and more fear in my class. Not all of the people, but certainly it's been there.
Mm.
And so I've been just ramping up some of the stress and calming techniques. I'm just doing more of that in the classes now than I used to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we always do a meditation at the end, but some of the breathing practices and those sorts of things I'm doing more often now than I was.
Mm.
So, you know, It's very difficult for some people.
Yeah, it is. That just stay there with us, Doug. That issue of yoga practice, or indeed any kind of practice where you're getting in connecting with your body physically and what it can do, Greg.
Mm.
We've known about the link between this and well-being for a long time, haven't we?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yoga is special, isn't it? Because it's exercise. It's also grounding, and Doug obviously knows more about this than I do, but the breath, attention on the breath parts of the exercise that Doug's just run for his class, that's about being in the present moment. So it's actually bringing together many of the themes of what we know from psychological research and psychological practice are, in fact, the most useful things that people can do. So yoga is one of those, you know, it's a perfect intersection, especially for some people, if there is a bit of that discussion about spiritual or, you know, existential issues, and some yoga practitioners put that into their classes more than others. But for some people, that's very, very meaningful.
Yeah. But, Doug, I would have thought when you're over 70, you've only got so many bends left, haven't you? Doug, well, you're suggesting that you might have a few more up your sleeve.
Well, I'm a retired electrician. I did 50 years in the trade, so bits of my body are worn out from trade work, not from yoga. But I came to yoga in the 80s through a bad time of depression and anxiety, and I've been going ever since.
Yeah.
So teaching now 25 or 26 years, but it's just at present, you know, the thing is about the class. If you don't take the tension out of the physical body, you can't really get the mental body to relax and calm down. And that's the structure of the classes. But we're doing more of the alternate nostril breathing as one of the practices, extending the out breath. Count the breath as it comes in and make the out breath a bit longer, all that sort of thing. We're doing a lot more of that than I would have been doing 2 years ago.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Anyway. Good on you, Doug. Long may you greet the sun. Okay.
I'll keep doing it as long as I can. Thanks, mate.
See you, Doug. Bye. Oh, dear. Doug and the downward dog, hey? That's I love stories like that. I think that's great, you know, because we often think, oh, well, you know, towards the back end of our life, it's all decrepitude and decay. It's not actually, no. But
the other thing I like about Doug's story, Phil, is that he actually moved into yoga through a period of distress himself.
Yes.
So it was out of the need to expand his repertoire of, you know, skills and ways of acting that he discovered yoga.
Yep.
And it's obviously become a really important and meaningful thing for him. And now he's handing it on to people who come to his classes.
Exactly right. All right, Greg, always good to talk. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Phil, and lovely to speak to your audience as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.